Welcome to Recovering Evangelicals, a podcast for people who were once very comfortable in the Christian faith until the 21st century intruded and made it very hard to keep on believing. I'm your host, Luke Jansen.
And I'm Scott Dyer.
Ryan McLaren is a well-recognized name in the evangelical community. He's been a college teacher, a full-time pastor, and an author of almost two dozen books. In 2015, not even 10 years ago, he was recognized by Time magazine as one of the 25 most influential evangelicals in America. But he's also been on a spiritual journey, reevaluating many of the Christian beliefs he once had. He, too, is a recovering evangelical. At this point in his journey, he identifies as a passionate advocate for a new kind of Christianity, one that joins arms with people of other faiths and works for social justice. And those books that he's written reflect a journey he's been on, with titles like A New Kind of Christian, The Secret Message of Jesus, Finding Our Way Again, A Generous Orthodoxy, The Great Spiritual Migration, Do I Stay a Christian? We interviewed Brian almost 3 years ago, episode number 53, when we talked about his latest book at that time, Faith After Doubt, Why Your Beliefs Stop Working and What to Do About It. I'd still highly recommend the listeners check that out again because that message is just as good today as it was then. But his latest book is not what you'd expect. The latest title to follow Faith After Doubt is Life After Doom. A very provocative title, and I'm going to leave it hanging like that, unexplained and ominous, for just a few minutes. But first, I'd like to introduce its author. Brian McLaren is here in our podcast studio once again. Brian, welcome.
So happy to be with you again.
Happy to have you. Excuse me for being a bit of a fanboy for a second, Brian. It's really an honor to meet you. I have read many of your books over the years, and they have been companions. You didn't know it, but you've been a dialogue partner for me on my own journey. So, and I sense if we ever met and had a beer or something, we'd probably click pretty good. We've read a lot of the same people, and so really thrilled to have you on here.
Well, thanks so much, Scott. Great to be with you. And thanks for those encouraging words.
No problem. So I guess before we dive into your latest book, which, like as Lucas said, is a bit of a departure or a seeming kind of departure, you could maybe address that. But just update us on where you are at in your journey. As you know, the podcast we do is all about people who are going through a deconstruction process. Some people are kind of reconstructing. Some people have left, you know, faith aside and moved on. And so your journey and your books obviously fit with that extremely well. So, but yeah, where would you say you're at these days?
Yeah. So I continue, you know, I feel a remarkable consistency in my calling. I grew up in for us, I never heard the word evangelical. We were so conservative. We just considered ourselves Christians and we weren't sure about anybody else, right? So today, my background, we would have been called fundamentalists or, you know, we were very, very sectarian and exclusive. And so I represented someone for whom the word evangelical was a whole lot of a bigger playground than I was used to. A lot more freedom than I've been used to. But what I remember feeling, I had a very, you know, kind of powerful spiritual experience as a teenager. And I just wanted to make the world a more loving, beautiful place. I remember when I was in college, one day I was sitting out on the grass, not smoking it, sitting on it near at my university. And I just felt, I was reading that Bible story about God saying to Solomon, what do you want? You can ask me for anything. And Solomon said, I want to be wise. And I remember saying, well, I want to be wise and I want to be loving. That's the two things I want. And so because in some ways my deepest spiritual experience had not really been owned by my church, it had happened, you know, outdoors, it had happened in different settings. I think I felt that calling has stayed with me, and I've been faithful to that calling through the years. But here's what I felt. I felt I want to help my little denomination or my little movement be more loving, more wise, more generous. It became clear they were not interested in any of that. They knew what they wanted to do, and anything I was offering wasn't what they wanted. So then I found myself in a larger evangelical world. And so I thought, I just want to help the evangelical world become more wise and more loving and more generous and more honest and so on. And, you know, I got the message pretty clearly. We're not interested in what you're saying. We think we're fine. And we definitely think that you're not one of us. And so, you know, in more recent years, I've been in the mainline Protestant world, and I want to help them do the same. But something has happened to me as well. I have changed my view to believe that God's span of concern is not the Christian religion, that God's span of concern is not even just the human species. I've become convinced that the span of concern that the Creator has is as big as all of creation. So I'm still just about that. I'm just trying to find the appropriate sphere to live it out. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's pretty clear. So, you know, you quote Kierkegaard, actually, one of my biggest heroes, if not my biggest hero.
Yes.
And in your new book, and the whole thing about the poetry and so on, which I read that analogy many years ago, and it's always stuck with me. But there's another one of his sayings that I've quoted on this program a few times. You know, when you label me, you negate me.
Yes.
And we want to label people, and you're not a person who fits labels very well. So I don't want to do that. And no, I think that's a good articulation of where you're at these days. I'm in that same process. So is Luke. And I think that's part of the problem, maybe, is that I feel like somehow I've got to come up, I've got to fit somewhere. I got to have some sort of label, but maybe I don't.
Maybe I
just don't fit anywhere. And maybe that's true of most people, but that's great. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And then I guess maybe just to follow on that, and Luke can pick this up, but that has led you into your realization of God's expanding concern for all of creation. Mm-hmm. And of course, your new book is about that. It's about all of creation and kind of what we're doing to it. So maybe talk a little bit about what led to the writing of the book.
Sure. Well, first, let me just say, if you and I have a love for Kierkegaard in common, we're practically second cousins at that point. So,
Okay. Great.
Maybe first cousins, maybe. We're certainly brothers. But one of Kierkegaard's struggles, as I understand him, is he looked around at his Denmark of his time, and virtually everybody was a Christian. And he felt that the term had become meaningless, you know, that the label didn't really mean anything if it applied to everybody. And I think this has been misinterpreted and maybe taken to extreme, but he loved to speak of the individual as opposed to the crowd. And he wasn't arguing for individualism, but he was arguing that we can't let our identity be imposed upon us by just belonging to a group. That part of being human is having some agency in our own identity. And I think, you know, a podcast like this speaks to people who inherited an identity, or at one point in their life chose an identity, belonged to a group, and then the identity became a problem, and they didn't feel in good conscience they wanted to just be labeled in that way. So to me, this is part of moral growth. In fact, even if a person doesn't think about it in relation to evangelicalism, any group that you're part of, you could change, the group could change, you and the group could change. And so our identities and belongings have to be renegotiated. Maybe I could just tell you a quick anecdote. This wasn't like a big moment in my life. It was a very small moment that is illustrative of what began to happen to me. While I was a pastor many years ago in the Washington, D.C. area, I was down in Washington, D.C. for some event. I can't even remember what it was. And I parked in a public parking garage, you know, one of those multi-level garages. And when I came back at, you know, 9 o'clock at night, it was locked and the gate was down. And there was a huge sign that I had passed driving in that said, "This garage closes at 7 p.m. You know, your car will be locked in." So now I'm standing in front of the garage thinking, how am I going to get home? You know, and it was kind of in an out of the way street. It wasn't like there was a cab going by. How am I going to get home? And there was a little number at the bottom of the sign. It said, "If you need help," and it gave a number. So I called the number, and the guy who was the night manager for the garage, who'd already closed up and gone home, came down from his apartment, walked a couple blocks, and helped me get my car out, was the nicest, kindest, loveliest man. And he was Muslim. And we were just small talking as we're walking through this garage. And he asked me what I did for a living. I said, I'm a pastor. And we had this wonderful conversation. And I thought, at this moment, we are two human beings, one stupid guy who locked his car and didn't read the sign, and one generous guy who came on his own after work and did me a favor. And when you realize that we're all in this together, in this sense, suddenly Jesus' words about loving your neighbor with no exceptions, no qualifications, have greater amount of meaning. And if you love your neighbor and your neighbor is under threat, you wake up to say, I've got to help my neighbor. Well, if you understand that the threat to your neighbor is a combination of things that are being created by our very way of life, and you realize that's a threat to you, and it's a threat to your children and grandchildren and future generations, you know, just that basic love makes you say, we need to wake up and take this seriously. So that really is what's behind this book, Life After Doom.
Oh, great.
Okay, so as we said earlier, this book, when I read it, it definitely was not what I was expecting. Yes. It's quite a change in direction for you. Your whole life, and you're now in your 70s, I understand, but all of your
60s, yeah, but getting there, yeah.
Okay. All of your adult years have been about getting humanity focused on an endpoint of utmost existential importance. But that uber important endpoint changed over the decades. So for the first few decades of your life, as a traditional evangelical Christian, that ultimate endpoint was all about getting into heaven or and or avoiding hell.
Yeah.
All of our listeners are familiar with that mentality. And for many, it's been the one of the reasons that they left that faith. And you also left that kind of thinking a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then for the next few decades, you grew into a worldview that said the big uber important endpoint was all about is to stop being so short-sighted and narcissistic, to stop ignoring the here and now on earth, and the mad rush for the bliss and abandonment of an eternal afterlife up in the clouds, and instead try to bring heaven down to earth here and now. And a smaller number of our listeners have made the same change. I'm one of them, and seeing that the gospel message is about the announcement of heaven and on earth and motivating us to be part of that revolution. That was you up until a decade ago, but now you've completely changed the paradigm once again. All this theological hand-wringing has been put to the back burner, and now there's a more immediate, more real threat that we need to focus on. The primary mission that all of humanity needs to get fully invested in now, right now, is to give our heads a shake, stop talking about heaven, and take a good look at the signs of the impending doom, and do whatever we can not to bring heaven down to earth, but to avoid creating an existential, ecological, environmental hell on earth. So that's, as I understand, the message of your latest book, Life After Doom, Wisdom and Courage for a World Falling Apart. Brian.
Well, listen, I'm intrigued by the way you say that. And I think there's some validity to that. I wouldn't say I've totally turned away from talking about God's will being done on earth as it is in heaven. But what I would say is, I think our current situation is worse than I thought and has been getting worse as time goes on. And so if we want the kind of world that we believe is God's will being done on earth as it is in heaven, we are plunging toward a very, very serious setback. And so that creates a deep sense of urgency. And maybe I could just say something about that setback as I understand it. In fact, first, let me just tell a quick story about this. I think you mentioned, I wrote two books in the mid-2000s. One was called The Secret Message of Jesus. That's where I really tried to grapple with that understanding of the Jesus' central message of the kingdom of God, which was not how do we go to heaven after we die, but how can God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven? I love the way you said that about, you know, heaven coming to earth. You go to the very last chapters of the book of Revelation, and the picture isn't of us being beamed up to heaven. It's of the new Jerusalem, this sort of visionary image of a new kind of city or civilization descending to the earth and bringing wisdom and healing to everybody, right? So it's not an upward, it's the elevator isn't going up. It's the elevator's coming down in that sense. But in 2006, I wrote that book, Secret Message of Jesus. Then the next book I wrote, I wanted to address the question, if God's concern is what kind of earth we co-create with God here on earth, what are the biggest challenges? What are the biggest problems? If we need to be concerned about what's going on here on earth, how are things going? And this was something I'd been curious about a long time. And so I spent about 18 months studying global crises in 2006, 2007 for that book. And it was, you know, I was kind of a normal, educated, middle-class white guy who was trying to understand what's the real state of the earth. And when I came to the end of that book, this question had popped up for me. And it was such a grave and difficult question that I didn't feel I could put it in the book. I didn't feel I could put it like at the end of the book, like for further research. I felt like if I mentioned this question, it would be so distracting. It would almost undercut, not contradict, but just, I felt I was saying important things in that book and I didn't want them all to be wiped away so quickly.
And, when you say distracting, you probably mean traumatizing.
I think so. That's right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And here was the question. In that book, I described the crisis of our civilization, that we have created a civilization that the more it succeeds, the faster it accelerates to suicide. The technical term for this is overshoot. We were sucking more resources out of the earth than the earth could sustain. And we were pumping out more waste products than the earth could detoxify. And so we were destroying our life support system. And the question that was in my mind at the end of the book is, we've created this global economy and a global civilization. And is it possible to turn the global civilization around? Is it even desirable to turn the global civilization around? Or is the best thing for the global civilization to fall apart so that something better can be built in the ruins? In other words, we'll never be able to change this civilization to be better to human beings and better to the earth. And the reason this came up for me is that in my research, I met people who just said, you're wasting your time to think about saving global civilization. It is a hopeless case. It is fatally flawed. There's nothing could be done. And I listened to them and I thought, I hope you're not right, because if you're right, it's a horrible future in the short run, even if there's a better future in the long run. But at the same time, I just thought, I've got to grapple with this. So that has been sort of the live question for me. When I've been writing all of these other books, this has sort of been what I've been working on in private. And I don't know the answer to that question. To me, it's not the kind of question that is even important that you answer. It's the kind of question that makes you see things differently. And that's why that really was what led to the writing of this book. And in some ways, the biggest contribution I hope this book will make, time will tell, but I tried to create four honest scenarios of what I think our future could hold. It'll be interesting to see. You know, I feel I've done my homework. I feel I've fairly synthesized the information that's out there. It will be interesting to see if experts in these fields will critique these four scenarios and say I missed something, or if they'll feel that they're honest and comprehensive, albeit uncomfortable. But yeah, that's what brought me to this point.
It's just kind of interesting that more and more, as I listen to various experts as well, just through, you know, just through YouTube and things like that.
Yes.
But more and more, the people who are the most in the know keep saying it's worse than we thought. And yeah. and there are certainly a good number of them that say it's not only worse than we thought, they're saying exactly what you're saying. It's too late.
Yeah.
You know, we're headed for now the level of the crisis and how it all, you know, nobody knows that, but it seems to be a growing sense. It's kind of interesting to me that the evolutionary narrative, what I would, at least as I was taught it, was, you know, from primitive to us, right? So from these little unthinking eukaryotes to Homo sapiens. And the chart kind of gives you that idea that this whole thing has been a progress, you know, that we are the kind of crowning achievement of evolution. But from the perspective of the earth, if you anthropomorphize the earth and said, the worst thing that ever happened to creation was the development of human intelligence, you know, because no creature has been able to wreak havoc on creation like we have, you know. And I just find that paradoxical and disturbing, you know.
Yes, yeah. And it takes a certain amount of courage to face and even think about what you've just expressed. And the result of this, some people just react and they won't even think about it. They double down on the idea that the whole point of everything is human beings. There's a Christian way of doing this. There is a kind of technopunk way of doing this and a kind of Silicon Valley way of doing this. I'm sure there's Muslim and Buddhist and other ways of doing this too. And it can lead some people to become misanthropic, where they end up hating human beings and kind of saying it would be great for us to just not exist.
Yeah.
and I understand why people might say that. We may prove that to be true. In other words, we may work ourselves out of existence. I think we could do that. But that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, in fact, the writing of this book, I feel a lot of anger. You know, for example, I am angry at the fossil fuel industry. You know, the fossil fuel industry knew how bad things were. Their own scientists understood this back in the 1970s. And they made, to me, the craven, despicable decision to not only cover up what they'd found, but to use huge amounts of money to mislead people so they could spend a few more decades making a few more trillion dollars at the expense of every single person alive and every person who ever will live. I mean, it will go down as a Holocaust level crime that was committed by men in business suits, right? In the 70s and 80s. And that continues with idiot, craven politicians today. So I'm super angry about that. It's wrong. But at the same time, the writing of this book made me feel a deep amount of compassion, because in some ways, we humans I think of Jesus' words on the cross, "Father, forgive them, they know not what they do." We have no idea how stupid we've been, how short-sighted we've been. And so instead of condemning people and saying they all deserve to die, I want to say, may we be forgiven. May we come to our senses. May we change our way of life.
Yeah.
Ryan, maybe we should get to that traumatizing part of the story that you were telling earlier. You were talking about those outcomes what the future might hold for us. I think this is where in your book you do this. Maybe we should do this in a podcast. Basically, issue a listener discretion is advised. In chapter 2, which has a title, yes, "Welcome to Reality," you describe four different realities that they're not happy pictures, but you're absolutely convinced we are going to experience one or more of these scenarios. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. So maybe I could begin, Luke, by saying that there are two kinds of collapse that we are facing. One is an environmental collapse. And when I say an environmental collapse, I mean there is a kind of balance, scientists call it homeostasis, a kind of dynamic tension that has been going on, you know, for some millions of years. And if our species has been around 250,000 years or so, there's a range of temperature and sea levels and consistency in which our entire history has taken place. Ecological collapse means we disrupt that. You know, there are periods, scientists know this now, when the entire earth was ice, right? The earth was covered in ice. There were periods where the temperature was so warm, there was no ice on the planet. And it was just a very, very different world. What we call ecological collapse means the balance that we humans are used to could be disrupted in a very, very significant way. Now, here's the second collapse. It's what we could call civilizational collapse, because we live We are dependent in a thousand ways that we take for granted because it's happened so gradually and so seamlessly, but we are dependent in a thousand ways on a very complex civilizational system. And if the ecology becomes destabilized enough, long before the ecological systems collapse, our civilization collapses. And then what becomes very terrifying is how human beings will behave as individuals and as nations in a world where that kind of civilizational collapse is ongoing. And something important to remember, very few civilizations collapse overnight. Rome wasn't built in a day, and Rome didn't collapse in a day. It took centuries. Generations of people lived and died. They didn't know they were in a collapse process. But now looking back, we realize, yeah, it started then and it continued for those couple hundred years. And life is different in a period of collapse than it is in a period of growth and even a period of stability or conservation. And everything that we assume about theology and about economics has been developing in a period of growth and stability. Put all of that in motion, and then you say, okay, what could happen from here? And I'll just mention those four scenarios. Collapse avoidance is the possibility that we can keep our civilization from collapsing so that it adjusts to and manages to continue through the ecological instability that we have coming. And I'm glad, Luke, as you read the book, that you saw that as not the good scenario, because I think a lot of people, when they hear civilizational collapse, they think, oh, that's the good one. How do we avoid the other three? I don't think any of them are great. And there are, believe it or not, upsides to each one, but it is the one that probably sounds the most comfortable for people and that people are understandably working for. The second is collapse rebirth,
Could I just help the listeners then? You're saying this first one is avoiding the civilizational collapse, but that doesn't mean civilization won't suffer. It's going to be greatly reduced, like maybe only a quarter of the number of people can live on this planet. Maybe just say for a minute, talk about that.
Yes. So the best estimate I've heard, if we wanted everyone on Earth to live with a European standard of living, which is a little lower than an American standard of living and higher than a lot of places, if we wanted everyone to live with a European standard of living, the Earth could maybe sustain 2.5 billion people. So we're at 8, and we're probably going to get to about 10 before we peak. Somewhere later in the century, 2070, we might hit 10 billion. And most people think that if we get there, that civilization, that human population will gradually decline. In fact, if people are interested, there's a whole panic right now, not only about excessive numbers relating to the Earth's ability to sustain, but they're worried about this thing called degrowth or depopulation. China, for example, has a kind of decline in population that could create a collapse of their entire society. So a lot of our civilization stability depends on growth. And when we stop growing numerically, we're in trouble, and it can be a very precipitous decline. But yes, it would mean some very, very tough decades, if not centuries. And let me just give people an example. In the Middle East, over the last 20 years, there was major conflict in Syria. And about 1 million Syrians left and became refugees. They joined a number of other Middle Eastern refugees and sub-Saharan African refugees. And so the Earth had between 1 million and 2 million refugees. And that was enough to create across Europe and across the United States a panic, an anti-immigrant panic. And it created a resurgence of fascism, a resurgence in Europe of Nazism, a resurgence in this country of the ugliest forms of white supremacy, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia. And we don't have to hypothesize about that. We've watched it happen. And my guess is in the coming months, we're going to see the ugliest faces of this continue to rise. Mm-hmm. I was in Charlottesville in 2017 as part of the clergy response to the Unite the Right rally. I saw Nazi flags and I heard Nazi chants among young white men in khaki pants and sports shirts marching down the street. So that's just 1.5 to 2 million refugees in the world created that kind of panic response. The number of refugees that will happen as the environment continues to destabilize, people can't imagine what the world will look like then. Yeah.
That's the best of the four scenarios. Civilization collapse, avoidance, but civilization diminishing.
Yes. Yes.
I'm sure you guys have been watching and hearing the news about the latest disaster in Gaza. And I was watching it this morning, and they showed this video of, this aid coming into Gaza. And it was far enough away that it looked like ants or something, you know, just attacking this food. And then, of course, all hell broke loose and the Israelis started firing, you know, and nobody even is sure yet what, but, you know, 100 people are dead, starving people, you know.
Yes.
And so to me, it's kind of metaphorical for what could happen on a grand scale, what you're describing, right? Just, you know, people at the end of the day, our most reptilian kind of response is to live, right? to stay alive. And we will do anything to do that, including, you know, turn on our neighbors and so on and so forth. So it's pretty bleak to think about that.
Yes. And I think for those of us in the United States, we always see that happening far away. But I think what Charlottesville and what January 6th and several other events like this have shown us, and even every mass shooting, I think, sort of sends a little chill up our spine because we realize this could get a whole lot worse, right? We realize it's not just over there. We aren't immune to this sort of thing. So now we're having to come to terms with, we've got a serious problem, and we have a lot of religious leaders and political leaders who, whether they're evil or just fools, they don't see this as an opportunity to bring forth maturity and call people to what we often refer to as our better angels, but they just refer to the ugliest and meanest parts of us. But on the other hand, that's not the only thing that happens in crisis. Sometimes in crisis, people pull together and great leaders arise. And sometimes we see our very, very best in crisis too. And so there are way better and way worse scenarios within scenario one. Collapse avoidance could have far better and far worse wings within that one scenario.
So, Brian, let's hear about scenario two, collapse and rebirth.
So in this scenario, the infrastructures of our civilization become unsalvageable. And out of the rubble and out of the ashes, people rebuild. You know, for all of us who are Christians, we have an interesting example of this in our history. In the 300s, in the 4th century, early 5th century, two things happened close to the same time. The first was the bishops of the church made a deal with the Emperor Constantine. Now, it's a complicated situation, but let me offer a very simple diagnosis. Rome was in trouble. They were already in trouble. They had expanded as far as they could expand without now getting diminishing returns on their expansion. They were in the late stages of conserving their empire and in the early stages of losing it. And Emperor Constantine realized that this budding Christian religion could help hold the thing together. It could give it some moral legitimacy and some social cohesion. And so he makes a deal with the bishops of the church. And in a sense, they allow him to become their leader in many ways. And this creates a whole new arrangement. When that happens, a lot of very sincere Christian leaders say, something doesn't smell right here. We aren't happy about this. We don't want a mansion paid for at the emperor's expense so that our religion becomes subservient, a part of his political party. And they go out into the desert and they establish these communes or communities And another place it happens is over on the far other side of the Roman Empire in Ireland, where the Celtic communities spring up. And they become what we could call the rebirth of civilization. If people want to read a book about this, Thomas Cahill wrote this beautifully written book called How the Irish Saved Civilization. Yeah. And it was a story about a collapse of civilization and a group of people who became the seeds of rebirth, of something that could arise after some tough centuries. What do we call those centuries? The Dark Ages, right? But, you know, generations of people lived in those ages. They were the best time. Those people never had a time that weren't in what we call the Dark Ages. So that's the second, that some of us can band together and form the kind of communities that can bring some rebirth of something good and noble and whole and holy, you know, whatever happens to the larger civilization.
I'm pushing us along here, sorry. Yeah. So if you want to just launch into 3 and 4, we should do that.
Sure, sure. So scenario 1, collapse avoidance. Scenario 2, collapse rebirth. Scenario 3 is collapse survival. And what this scenario proposes is that on its way down, civilization will do so much harm that we won't be able to rebuild. We won't rebuild civilization. We will rebuild some form of life in the ruins of civilization, but we will blow ourselves back to a very, what we would call a primitive way of life. But, you know, there it is. It may be more sustainable than the way of life we have now. It probably won't be anything close to the population that we have now. It will be a very, very different life, collapse survival. And then the fourth is collapse extinction. And some people, I think, speak of this very glibly, but to me, this is the scenario of the human race on its way down, doing every stupid thing it could do. nuclear war, chemical war, biological war. I mean, we have all the tools at our disposal now to do unbelievable harm to ourselves. And the irony of this is it creates almost this spiritual realization. If any nation thinks it can use these kinds of weapons to defend itself and hurt others, they're fools. Any nation that unleashes these tools will create a world that is a horrible world to live in. It brings new meaning to Jesus' words, whoever wants to save his life will lose it. You try to save yourself at the expense of everyone else, and you will not survive either. So we're at this moment where the possibility, though, that human beings could keep acting out of our old scripts and think we'll solve our problems by weapons, warfare, hatred, supremacy, conquest, domination. And it is way too easy to imagine a suicidal scenario for our species. And unfortunately, if our species goes, we very likely bring along a huge percentage of the Earth's, well, maybe huge is a relative number, a significant percentage of the Earth's species with it.
Brian, as you describe these scenarios, some listeners might be saying, it won't get that bad. Mm-hmm. And in the book, you're very apologetic. You acknowledge that, look, this is hard news, and you actually, you know, will address the trauma that the people might be experiencing, even to the point of you provide resources for mental health. But I just wanted to say, I had my daughter read the book. She's getting her master's in, I forget the exact title, but it's essentially sustainability in business, trying to be ecologically and environmentally aware in business. She said that what you said is all very true. In fact, as she said it, it's a quarter of what she hears in her classes. Yeah. They're saying the same things at 4 times the volume.
Yes. This is the thing. It's been interesting. You know, the book isn't even out yet, but the title getting out and a few of the advanced reader copies getting out, I am hearing one group of people saying, wow, this is super shocking and disturbing. And another group of people saying, what a relief. Somebody's saying the quiet part out loud. Mm. Somebody's saying what we're hearing in our classes or what we're talking about at parties late at night with our friends. And I think those of us who are older, what's normal for us, we don't realize is not normal for our children and grandchildren. They are already in a different world. It's so interesting. I've spent a lot of time in Africa, a good bit of time in Asia, Latin America, and people in the West think that we're smart and advanced. The truth is, so many of us are so far behind the times. The rest of the world sees the trouble we're in so much more clearly.
I read a book many years ago, and it sounds like some sort of religious crazy guy, but it was called The Arrogance of Humanism. And at that time, humanism was a big, people were talking a lot about secular humanism and things like that. But the book was written by a non-religious person. It wasn't about that at all. And do you know the book by any chance?
No, I don't know.
Okay. Anyway, it was a fascinating book. And what he basically argues is that our hubris is going to kill us.
Yes.
You know, that we think that we're so smart. And he puts a lot of this responsibility, frankly, on the sciences and so on, that give people a false confidence. And I think they're in the West, at least, even for myself, I have to say that I do often think at times, well, you know, somehow maybe we'll develop a technology that gets us past all this, you know, and when you look at news feeds and, of course, social media these days, it's just inundated with things like they just invented this. This is going to change everything there. Now we're going to have, cold fusion. Now we're going to, you know, there's a real seems to be in the West, especially a real hankering after some sort of technological solution that we're not going to have to change. We can just keep living the way we are now and, you know, wasting and all that kind of stuff. And the science will save us. Did you come across that kind of?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, you know, among people who take our current situation seriously, there is, you know, a good bit of bitterness between different people. Some people who feel the techno-optimists, as they're called, are hastening us toward destruction. And the techno-optimists look at people and they call them doomers and misanthropic and all the rest. And they're hastening us toward destruction because they're not joining in the work. And, you know, I have empathy for all of these people. Like, I am all for technological advancement. But here's the problem. And here's where the irony is for people like us who grew up in an evangelical context. We grew up in a context that said human beings have a fundamental spiritual problem. And until there's a spiritual shift, we're in deep trouble. The irony is, I think that's what I'm saying. We have a fundamental spiritual problem. The problem is that the Christian religion, by and large, has the same spiritual problem and is and is one of the most resistant pockets. Not all sectors of the Christian religion. Some sectors of the Christian religion are way out in front of this. You look at Pope Francis and you think how blessed we are to have a Pope Francis who, to a degree far ahead of 99.9% of Catholics and even more Protestants, understands something of the gravity of our situation. But the irony is, I think if we develop new technology and work on the same old spiritual framework, and by spiritual framework, I mean how we're formed, the values that we hold at the deepest level, how we see ourselves, what story we believe we're part of in this universe. If we go on the same old stories and have new technologies, it just gives us more power to cause more destruction sooner. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Brian, you did mention that you mentioned Protestants and certain other strands of Christian thinking. They are aware of the problem and they're working towards a solution. But maybe comment on the part in your book that I found especially provocative and interesting and challenging. You talked about the oversized role that evangelicals and also ex-evangelicals, because I'm an ex-evangelical, we were part of that worldview, that they're playing an outsized role in this problem. One of the reasons why I think we played such a role is that we had this mentality that it's all going to burn anyway. Jesus is coming back and he's going to burn up the earth. So we're just going to go ahead. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure.
Oh, and especially, I remember this now too, when I read the book, you talk about a conference you went to that was, I think, an evangelical conference. You know what I'm talking about. So why don't you talk about that?
Yeah. So, you know, now it's in the book. I've forgotten the year, but there was a conference held in Maryland, where I lived, called the Sandy Cove Conference. And this brought together evangelical leaders. And it was one of the best planned conferences I've ever been to, in the sense that the organizers got evangelical Christians who understood climate change and related ecological problems and had a beautiful evangelical theology that wasn't a theology of dominion in the sense of domination over the earth. It was it was a sense of stewardship and responsibility to care for the earth, to have the same love and care for the birds of the air, the flowers of the field, the fish of the sea, that the creator would have for the creator's beloved creation. And they had amazing speakers. And all I can say is that after the first morning of the conference, any sane person would have understood that climate change is real. We human beings are behind it, and we better get together to try to do something about it. And one of the leaders, and he was from the Southern Baptist denomination, and he said, whether or not this is true, I can tell you that the Southern Baptists will not support this. They will not go along with you on this. And people said, why won't they? They said, because we believe in small government conservatism and free market solutions. And if this problem is as bad as you're saying it is, it will require big government and big solutions that put regulations on business, and we will oppose it for that reason. Now, whether he agreed with that or not, or he was just being an informant to us of how his people thought, I was never sure. Mm-hmm. But what it told me is that you put together evangelical, some of the worst elements of evangelical theology, one of them being dispensationalism and rapture theology, which is just a ridiculous interpretation of the Bible. If evangelicals like me, who were sincerely taught dispensationalism and the rapture and all that, if we were to hear the legitimate theological critiques just on biblical scholarship, we would realize this was a really bad idea injected into Christian history in the 1830s by a little sect called the Plymouth Brethren that I grew up in. So I'm criticizing my own tribe in saying that. But that's one big problem. But then maybe the worst problem is when you combine that with people who've made commitments to economic ideologies that they theologically justify. But the truth is, I'm just going to say it. The truth is, money rules in most of Christianity. The people who make a lot of money give a lot of money, and they give money to churches that do not criticize the way they made their money. and that helps explain how slavery could exist among people who thought of themselves as such great Christians, how the slaughter of the Native Americans and First Nations in North America, and the same pattern is repeated in Africa and Asia and many other places. So, it's very, very disturbing. But then you face how bad it is and you say, okay, I don't want to just attack or criticize those other people. What are we going to do? What am I going to do that is morally responsible?
I wonder if a recent memory of COVID is a bit instructive. One of the reasons that I become pretty pessimistic is just our nature as human beings. We don't change until we have to, right?
Yeah.
So we didn't really do anything with COVID until it got to the point where we couldn't not do anything. You know, so there were lockdowns and there were things like that. And there was a lot of controversy about it. But the fact is that we had to.
Yes.
Is it the same with this? In other words, it really is. It'll change. There'll be bits and pieces and advancement and stuff like that. But do we really need maybe some sort of major, obvious climate crisis that hopefully doesn't kill us, but takes us to the point where every human being on the planet says, okay, I'm buying into this. Like, we can't not. What do you think of that?
Yeah. Well, here's where, you know, the Bible has this fascinating story of the Hebrew people being enslaved in Egypt, and they, in a sense, they've experienced the downside of civilization. They've been the oppressed of civilization. And they've been shaped by it. Even though they're the victims, it's wounded them and distorted them and shaped them. And so they leave and they have to go through this long period in the wilderness, which we see as a bad thing. I'm tending to see the wilderness as a wild and natural place that re-disciples them to live in harmony with the earth and takes away all of the comforts and trappings of civilization so that they encounter the naked reality of living as a creature in this world. And that becomes almost their rebirth, to take those four scenarios. That becomes a rebirth scenario to where they now get a chance. Of course, what happens, they enter the promised land. The violence of their entry is super problematic, but once they get established, By the way, they're told, you better be sure you're good to other refugees because you've been refugees. You better be sure, right? And then they decide to build a temple. Solomon decides to build a temple, and he uses slave labor to build the temple. Well, a little known fact in the Hebrew Bible. And in a sense, you see, the Jewish people, when they tell their story, says, see, we became just like the Egyptians. We are part of that problem. And so then the prophets arise and they start saying, we need a new heart. We need a new start, you know? And, yeah. And into that tradition, Jesus comes and says, you know, we got to have a, I think that, you know, for those of us who are evangelical, a lot of us are sick of the way that term born again was used with all kinds of horrible psychological and sociological effect. But if you try to say, what could Jesus have meant by that was good? He certainly didn't mean what we have turned it into meaning. Maybe he meant something like this. We have to imagine a new kind of human being, a new kind of humanity, which interestingly is a phrase that Paul picks up.
Yes.
And so the irony of all this is all the core resources of my faith are a huge asset to me as I think about this moment. Yeah. Mm.
So, Brian, we're almost out of time and we're only halfway through the book. So let's talk about you. You don't only dramatize and call attention to the problem. You're suggesting, well, I can't call them solutions, but there are things that you suggest we need to do to manage the problem, to manage the collapse. And like a good Baptist minister, you've broken up into four parts, your sermon, letting go, letting be, letting come, and setting free. So why don't you tell us about those?
Yes. Well, you know, in the contemplative tradition of Christian faith that some people call the mystical tradition, that word mystical has a problematic connotations for a lot of people. But in the contemplative tradition, there is this understanding that the way up is down, that our attempts to climb, our attempts to achieve, our attempts to dominate are counterproductive, and that our real growth begins when we descend. Some of the ancient church scholars and leaders and contemplatives called this purgation, that we have to go through a period where we are purged of our illusions and purged of our egocentric, selfish thinking. This is very much what the word repentance originally meant. It didn't mean some preacher makes you feel guilty for having a sexual thought. It meant that you say, repentance would have been if white people in the midst of colonizations would have said, what are we doing to indigenous people? What are we doing with enslaving people? This is sick. This is wrong. We got to stop this. No money is worth how we're dehumanizing other people and ourselves through this behavior. That would be repentance. And that is the letting go. Then the letting be is not rushing to fix things. Now, I'm not saying be lackadaisical, because as my dear friend and hero, really, Bill McKibben says, this is a timed test and winning too slowly is the same as losing. But letting be says, it's not that I'm okay and I just need solutions. It says, I'm part of the problem, my ways of thinking, my assumptions. And I have to let myself sit in this difficulty long enough to learn the lessons that I really need to learn and to actually be transformed and changed in some way. The contemplatives call this the dark night of the soul. And I think in a certain sense, our civilization is going to have to go through some kind of dark night. And then out of that comes letting come. The creative ideas that we need, in some ways, probably the ones we really need, we can't even imagine now because our thinking is so constricted by the assumptions of the civilization that shaped us. And then setting free. Once we've gone through this process, we could be free for new possibilities, whether it's new ways of avoiding collapse or ways of rebuilding after collapse or surviving after collapse. So that's how those four, it seems to me, fit together.
One thought that's come across my mind as we've just been talking is kind of, they talk about mass extinction events, right? And yes. Particularly the dinosaurs, you know, and I just thought crosses my mind, you know, the next asteroid is us.
Yes.
Like, don't worry about the asteroids out there, you know, like not likely going to hit us anytime soon, but we are the next mass extinction event. And I think that's what I'm hearing through our whole discussion.
And, you know, this is where the work that you and the listeners to your podcast are doing is deeply relevant. I grew up in this fundamentalist evangelical setting, and my identity was fused with that setting, with that community. It was who I am. And when I said the word Christian, they defined what Christian meant. And when I said the word good, they defined what good Christian meant, right? My whole identity was fused with that. And I went through a period of many, many years where I gradually had to disentangle my identity from all of those, or so many of those assumptions. And I had to scrutinize them, think critically about them. If we want to use a religious word, have deep discernment about them and say, which of these do I want to invest my one, as Mary Oliver says, my one wild and precious life? Where do I want to invest my life? And I think what we're going to find out is that we are not our civilization if we choose to disentangle ourselves. And people who've learned to disentangle themselves from a small religious sectarian identity, it may be that we are getting practice, and it may be that that practice will actually help us be leaders in helping others engage in this larger disentanglement process. And that's why when people say, you know, humans don't deserve to survive, well, I might say human civilization, based on its current set of values and assumptions, it's not that it doesn't deserve to survive. It just can't. It can't survive. It's unsustainable. It does not fit with its environment. It doesn't fit in this world. But that doesn't mean that humans only have the option of being the way we've been this run. And that, to me, is an option that doesn't become that clear to you unless you've gone down that path of descent, that letting go to a place of letting be. That's one of the things that comes, I think, when you try to let, when you sit in the discomfort long enough to let it come.
So that was a whirlwind tour, a fast leafing through your book, Brian. Is there anything else that you think needs to be said about the book or about this topic before we wrap up this episode?
Well, I'm just so grateful for your good questions, and I'm grateful for your work as friends in conversation, inviting other people into these conversations, because I kind of have a feeling that podcasts like this create the kind of spaces we need for people to do this creative thinking. People might be sitting in their car and they're introduced to ideas that they don't know any other place where they could hear a conversation like this. So I'm just grateful that we could have this conversation. And in a certain sense, we have to trust every listener to now let this take them in a good and positive direction.
Thank you. Now, it's our normal practice to ask what's coming down the pipeline. Any new books for you?
So I actually, my next book will be the beginning of a trilogy of science fiction novels that try to explore some of the same ideas that are in this book. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow. Have you written any fiction up to this point?
I wrote a trilogy that you might call instructive fiction or educational fiction called A New Kind of Christian back in 2001 to 2005. But this will be a little more fiction and more in the science fiction genre.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Brian. We're going to put some links in our show notes for you, your website, and your book.
Thank you so much.
It was great talking to you.
Yeah, thank you, Brian.
What a pleasure, gentlemen. Keep up the good work.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Recovering Evangelicals with your hosts, Luke Jansen and Scott Dyer. Send your comments and suggestions for new episodes to lukejjansen@gmail.com. Join our private discussion group on Facebook by searching for the Recovering Evangelicals podcast group. Look for the logo that you always see at your favorite podcast catcher and ask to be let in. Subscribe to lukejjansen.wordpress.com if you want to get advanced releases and group posts. Or browse through our archive for a full listing of all our previous episodes. And please help the podcast by sharing with a friend and leaving a review at your favorite podcast catcher.